From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today on Transition Lab, we're talking to filmmakers Ken Burns and writer and historian Jeffrey Ward. They've collaborated on a number of award-winning films, including The Civil War, Baseball, The Vietnam War, Roosevelt's, and the many others. Ken is simply the best documentary filmmaker in history, and Jeff is an eminent historian and a beautiful storyteller and writer. They're here to talk to us about presidential transitions and how the past informs our understanding of the present. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So you all have worked together. We were talking earlier. You've worked together for 37 years, which is just incredible. How did you all meet and how did you get started doing this?
It was suggested when I was working on my second film for public broadcasting on the history of the celibate religious sect, the Shakers. I thought I was struggling, and someone suggested maybe this guy who used to edit American Heritage magazine and who was a great historian in his own right might have a word of wisdom. And so in 82, he came up. We started a collaboration that began with the next film on Huey Long, which he wrote and has continued to this day.
So you met and then you said, let's do some films together, or how did that work?
Well, you know, I was asked him first to just consult and be an advisor on the Shaker film, which, as he very nicely put it, was just saying, wow, it was a lot more than that. And then we had an opportunity to hire a senior academic advisor for the Huey Long film. And I just did a little bait and switched and turned it into the writer of it. And he wrote this magnificent script for Huey Long. And we've rarely not been working on something every single moment together since then.
And Ken, did you always know you wanted to be a filmmaker? And Jeff, did you always know you wanted to be a historian?
I knew pretty early that I wanted to be a filmmaker. My mom had died when I was 11. And when I was 12, I watched my dad cry for the very first time that I saw. And it was at a movie, and he was watching a movie and he broke down in tears. And I realized what an incredibly powerful emotional tool it was and could be, that the only safe emotional harbor he could find was in filmmaking. So I vowed right then and there to be a filmmaker, but that meant a feature filmmaker. And when I went to Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts in the early 70s, all of the people there were social documentary still photographers and filmmakers. And I sort of got my molecules rearranged there.
And Jeff, did you always know you wanted to be a historian?
To be a historian? Yeah, I guess so. I studied painting in school, in Oberlin College. And I was an editor and then a writer and then a magazine editor. But I'd always been interested in history. It's always fascinated me ever since I was a kid. And I had an Aunt Mary who gave me landmark books. Well, there's a wonderful series starting when I was very young, and she gave them to me till I was in my 30s. They were children's books. But I've always loved the opportunity to reach millions of people with the stuff that means so much to me.
Where did you really learn to be a great writer and storyteller?
Well, I'm not sure I'm a great writer, but I don't know. I just working on this stuff, there's something about storytelling. My dad was a very good storyteller. We were sort of raised to tell pretty good stories. To me, it's more interesting than fiction.
Well, Ken, you're a famous guy, but I think you're famous for one area where most people, maybe you didn't think you were going to be famous in this area, which is my son had a bar mitzvah. We made a video for him and we used something called the Ken Burns effect. So how did that come about? And did you know you were going to be famous among Jewish teenagers?
Well, I've saved lots of bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and weddings and vacations and things like that. No, that's the technological tail wagging the dog. I have been a kind of energetic consumer of still photographs, and I wasn't content to hold them at arm's length. So over the course of 43 years of working at this stuff, I've use these still photographs in different ways. And Steve Jobs, who became a friend in the early aughts, invited me in to Apple and said that he had people working on what he called the Ken Burns effect, a very simple, you know, very superficial, not critically, but superficial version of what we're doing in very complex ways, not just physically and kinesthetically, but emotionally and artistically, we hope, where you could pan and zoom on your photographs. That's become a thing. I'm really glad that when, by the time that became a thing, kids had already been subjected to our work, Jeff and my work, in school. So it wasn't necessarily their first encounter with me. Though I did have one teenager come up to me and said, "You did Lois and Clark?" And I said, "No, I did Lewis and Clark." And it was great disappointment and consternation that he hadn't hit some, you know, Hollywood director, but in fact, hit, you know, somebody who made, I think, a pretty good documentary on Lewis and Clark.
That's hilarious.
Well, let's turn to the subject of history. And we're in the biggest crisis our country has faced maybe since World War II today.
Absolutely.
What can history teach us about the moment we find ourselves in?
The vital importance of national leadership. We don't do well without it. Presidents need to define where we are and assure us things are going to go well and have a plan. I think that was the great gift of Franklin Roosevelt, and I think it's essential to our health and survival.
Jeff, is there a historical corollary to today? What's the greatest parallel in U.S. history to what we're facing today?
I'm always a little uneasy with parallels. I suppose 1933 is certainly one, and 1861 is the other. I think this is the third of them.
This is the third biggest crisis our country's faced.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, we're going to talk about those two presidential transitions from Buchanan to Lincoln and from Hoover to Roosevelt. And Ken, we were talking earlier this week, and I was lamenting how presidential transitions are never perfect. They always have problems. And you had a more optimistic view. So what's your view on how historical presidential transitions have gone in the United States?
Well, first, let me just echo that I agree completely with what Jeff said. This crisis is on the level of the Second World War, but particularly the Depression and the Civil War. As Lincoln predicted in an early speech, that our danger didn't come from without, but from within. And now that's literally medically, epidemiologically true, but also politically and socially true as well. So this is as great a crisis as we've had. But when you spoke about it, I think as you narrow in, you know, as we tend to do, and we want to say, well, this person didn't like this person did this and did this, let us step back a little bit and celebrate that since whatever it was, 1797, when George Washington gave up the presidency after two terms and John Adams took over, we have had an unbroken succession of presidential administrations. No troop has been alerted. Nobody's fought and said no. They may have gone unhappily, but they've gone. And so at least to this moment, and I'm not sure that it's guaranteed in the future, at least to this moment, the very fact, unique in human history, that we've had this unbroken chain of transitions means it has been, when you step back, terrific. You know, do you love your brother? Yes. Did you fight? Yup. Right? I mean, this has been the greatest, most amazing thing. Human beings, as Thomas Jefferson said, are wont to suffer tyrannies. And we decided not to. We created a government unbelievably imperfect in its scope and understanding, and yet able, for whatever this is, 230 something years, to be able to hand off the ball without a single fumble. That's amazing. Let's celebrate that.
Agree. Well, let's celebrate that. And let's go to what Jeff said was the last big moment like today, 1861. So Lincoln wins in 1860. There's a four-month interregnum, and in those 4 months, seven states secede. So that's a pretty big problem that Lincoln faced. What was he doing during those 4 months to actually prepare to take the presidency?
He had, a unique problem. He was, first of all, seven states had seceded. There was another president, Jefferson Davis, and another government. This is when we came as close as we ever did to breaking Ken's correctly described chain. It was essential to him that he not make more states secede, that he say nothing to make things worse. The Buchanan was paralyzed, unable to do anything. He was just living in the White House. He was accomplishing nothing. Lincoln really couldn't do anything until he got there. And he also had no wiggle room on the platform of his party, on which he won less than 40%, I guess, of the vote. he couldn't compromise at all one way or the other on that. So in one sense, he's the most eloquent man saying very little that we've almost ever had. There's a wonderful new book by Ted Widmer called Lincoln on the Verge, which is just about that train trip he took during the transition as he moved to Washington. And I, you know, anybody who wants to know about that should read that extraordinary book.
I just ordered it, in fact. And let's go to a clip that describes that train trip and Lincoln's entry into Washington.
In Philadelphia, warned of plots to kill him, Lincoln declared he would rather be assassinated than see a single star removed from the American flag. 2 days later, he reluctantly canceled plans for a grand arrival in Washington and slipped into the Capitol by train at dawn, wrapped in a shawl and protected by two armed guards.
Buchanan just was doing nothing, and he did nothing to ease Lincoln's entry into office?
Not at all. And we have to realize it's a different time. Information is traveling. Human beings are traveling at a different rate. Lincoln's a Westerner who by surprise has won the nomination and by surprise has won the presidency. He has to make a trip in which he has to kind of back and fill with all of the other people who thought they were better at the job or would be better at the job than him. And then I think he had to come to Washington. The non-actor here is Buchanan. You know, up until recently, many historians favorite as the worst president ever. You know, this is a hugely inactive person, as Jeff is suggesting. And what's amazing is that by the time he's up there getting his inauguration, there are really 9 states, soon to be 11, that are going to join the Confederacy. And he's got a job in that first inaugural address to sort of remind people of why they cohere. And one of the greatest things, to go back to Jeff's point, is his last sentence. You know, he's looked out on the mostly Southerners there and said, "We must not be enemies. We must be friends. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection." And then he says this unbelievable, stupefying final sentence, which is the most poetic sentence I know that he ever wrote. He says, realizing that they still share this revolutionary past in common, he said, "The mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature." In one magnificent poetic sentence, he described exactly what was going to happen. He described the fact that of what good leadership was about. And he showed empathy, which we'll find is a key ingredient. Do I understand how someone else feels? Not just even my supporters, not just the dead, but what does the people on the other side understand and do? He set the bar. That's the transition right there. He'd rather be assassinated than have a star removed. And no stars were moved. In fact, 2 were added, West Virginia and Nevada. So, you know, that's pretty good. And he never called them the Confederacy. He never recognized them. In fact, the official name of the Civil War in the United States government is the War of the Rebellion. He referred to them only as rebels. And it is a magnificent job of discipline and attention that saved our country, saved our country.
In addition to his astonishing eloquence, the empathy that Ken describes, he was a master politician. And I contend that whenever we've had a serious crisis, the people who save us are people who understand politics and see it as the honorable profession that it is. He liked to say, "I don't know much about how things are done in politics." But it was a pose. He had furious ambition and an ingenious way of figuring out how to, with a velvet glove, defang his enemies. And those are incredibly rare gifts, and they are essential to being a great president.
What in his youth, or what in his upbringing, he had a lot of suffering and hardship. What do you think gave him both that steely spine and that empathy that made him such a great leader?
You know what? I've always said, and Jeff's one of the greatest biographers that I know, that all of biography, indeed all of history, because Thomas Carlyle suggested that all history is biography, is failure. Because even those people closest to us in our own lives remain in some degree inscrutable. And how do we presume to get into the minds and the hearts of people who lived 100, 200, 300, 500, 1,000 years ago and accurately bring them back? We can't. We're still nonetheless obligated to strive, just as none of us are getting out of this business alive. We're still nonetheless obligated to do, to be, to make things, to create, to raise families, tend gardens, whatever it might be. But what you feel in Lincoln, the loss of a mother, the steely resolve at education, the masterful early days as a lawyer, the eloquence that comes from Shakespeare and the Bible, and the ability to speak, as someone said, with the bark on, that he understood how ordinary folks on the frontier spoke, and that kind of humor gave him a relationship to the inscrutable ways of life that combined with that ambition, and Jeff is absolutely right, this is a hugely ambitious person and an extraordinary politician in the best and worst senses of the world. And he did that again and again and again. And then staying with the program, even as it brought him opprobrium from people who wanted to move faster, say, like Frederick Douglass on emancipation and civil rights, or to generals who felt like they knew better than him how to be the commander in chief. At the end of the day, you just look at it as some sort of complicated providence.
Incredible. Well, let's move to another great president and another crisis in our time, the Hoover to FDR transition. So at that time, the country faced a deep crisis, political polarization, a debate over the role of the states, and the question was, would Roosevelt rise to the task? So here's a clip from your film, The Roosevelts.
A president could be judged great, Theodore Roosevelt once explained, only if he had faced and overcome a great crisis. Franklin Roosevelt would find himself confronted by the two greatest crises since the Civil War.
So let me ask you the same question. So you have a four-month interregnum. Roosevelt's elected in November, but he doesn't take office until March 5th. What is he doing during this time to take over and be ready?
Let me just begin with him. I've done four books on him and this film, and I think about him all the time because he's so impenetrable and so fascinating. Just as Ken said, he, like Lincoln, is mysterious. He's a very different kind of person. But he came to this job with this extraordinary optimistic spirit, this quality of empathy that, again, Ken talked about, and a supreme self-confidence. He really believed that if he was in charge of whatever he was in charge of, it was going to work out fine. And he managed to convey that. Herbert Hoover was the opposite of that. He was a grim person. It's not fair to say paralyzed, but certainly reluctant to use federal power in this crisis. He believed that by principle, a lot of things should not be done so that everything could shake out, which ignored the plight of millions of people without jobs and whose bank deposits were threatened and so on. And Hoover was determined to make Roosevelt sign on to his policies. FDR was just as determined not to do so. So he prepared a program. He accepted the fact that there was nothing he could do until he took power, and he refused to get lured into signing on to things in which he did not believe. To me, it was an extraordinary performance. There are people who think somehow, and certainly Hoover thought, that somehow it was irresponsible. I don't see how he could have done anything other than what he did.
So do you think that the fact that they didn't work together, they didn't collaborate, did that extend the depth of the crisis and did that slow the recovery?
I don't think so, because I don't think there was any way you could compromise the two sets of policies they had. The other element in this is just a personal one. They couldn't stand each other, and that made it more difficult. Roosevelt blamed Hoover for an event which probably wasn't really his fault, which was in the spring of 32, when Roosevelt was hoping to persuade the Democratic Party to nominate him. There was a gathering of the nation's governors at the White House. And the Roosevelts arrived a little early because of the difficulty FDR had in walking. It's a long way to the East Room. And he ended up having to stand up for half an hour. And he privately, and Mrs. Roosevelt later in a book, pretty much said that they thought they had done that to him on purpose. I don't think that's true. I think Hoover was late getting to the reception line. But Roosevelt wouldn't accept chairs because he didn't want people to see him as being unable to stand for a long time. So anyway, there was a lot of personal animus between the two of them. Hoover thought he was a lightweight and a second-rate person and insincere, and he called him a chameleon on plaid. So it was a very difficult personal relationship.
And Ken, you've done a lot of work on the combination of Roosevelt's upbringing, the fact that he was on top of the world, and then he's struck with polio. And how did that episode and that disease impact who he was and his development of empathy?
Well, I think you've hit the jackpot right there. That's one of the keys. He does remain, as Jeff said, inscrutable and kind of opaque and impossible to understand. But the main question is, how did this pampered, adored child who could do anything, who was handsome and athletic and kind of rather thin and not substantive, suddenly is stricken at age 39 with infantile paralysis and never walks unaided again in his life, is able somehow to get us through the two great crises that the narration that Jeff wrote brilliantly that you played a second ago is it. George Will said in our film that when the steel went on his legs, it went into his soul. And I think that's true, except steel implies a kind of coldness. And what I think he gained, or it accelerated something, being married to Eleanor also helped. For all of their differences and difficulties, they truly loved one another. And she brought with her a sense of purpose in the service of others. And together with the polio, you have a concoction, a vaccine that actually inoculated him and therefore the rest of the country that would get us through not just the Great Depression, the Second World War, intact. FDR and Lincoln are right there kind of tied for number one in terms of the great. You can disagree with their policies. You can disagree with how they did. Both of them made huge and glaring mistakes. But a sign of their leadership was their willingness to accept those mistakes, to acknowledge them publicly, to take the blame, to have the buck stop with them, and to move on and try something else. It's extraordinary. And if you think about the empathy embodied in Lincoln's first inaugural sentence that I cited, and then you listen to the first fireside chat, people actually got up and put their money back in the banks because some disembodied voice of a patrician who couldn't walk made them think that he knew them as well as anyone knew them, right? Somebody said, Jeff quoted this in the film, somebody said, FDR is the only person who knows that my boss is an SOB. Actually, Bill Luchtenberg told us that in the film. The great historian Bill Luchtenberg told us that in the film. And that was it, you know? Or Roosevelt is God. And in polls, he'd come in ahead of God. And God was a distant second. This notion that people could hear this disembodied voice and feel that he knew what they were going through. And this is a very well-to-do patrician guy with a, you know, whose mom's got a big mansion on the Hudson River. I mean, this is an amazing act of great politics, by the way. And I agree with Jeff. This is a noble, noble pursuit.
When you look at them, Lincoln and Roosevelt seem very different. One is very eloquent. One of them needed speechwriters to be eloquent and so on. There are a lot of differences. But there are things that are similar. One of them is absolute mastery of politics, of how to persuade people of things, of how to educate people to what they needed to do, what the country needed to do. But they are both truly opaque human beings. They are both undersold by the people who knew them when they were young, who never could quite get used to the fact that they were great men. You know, people who knew Lincoln in New Salem and people who went to Harvard with Roosevelt. And think what a difference that is between New Salem and Harvard. The other thing is they both had a great political trait, which was that when people went into their office to try to persuade them of something, they were capable because they knew what they wanted to do, of making those people think they agreed with them. It is startling to me to read accounts of people who went into Lincoln's office convinced they had convinced Lincoln of something he didn't want to be convinced of. And exactly the same thing happened with Roosevelt. I think it's part of political skill. There's a sort of easy empathy. There's a way of nodding and smiling when people talk, which makes the visitor think that the president has been enlisted in their cause. It isn't necessarily true. He has heard them out. And it's a great skill in getting what you want done.
And Hoover famously met with Roosevelt after the election, and he thought he had convinced Roosevelt to kind of give up on many of the New Deal policies because Roosevelt nodded and grinned. And
that's right. And also because he really thought Roosevelt was a, playboy lightweight. He had seen him when he was young, when he was some of those things. That's exactly right. And Roosevelt smiled and said, that's interesting. And he thought he was persuaded. He was not persuaded.
And Ken, in one of your episodes of The Roosevelts, there was just this poignant moment where you were talking about polio and you asked Jeff a question. Jeff was on camera and he started to cry. What happened there?
Well, I wanted to get from the person who I felt knew the man, the human being, this opaque and impossible to understand. I thought I was interviewing the person who understood that person the best. And the key to understanding at least a large portion of FDR is this big dramatic thing that happens to him. And I should really seed the situation. I do a lot of interviews, and it's rare that I get the chance to interview Jeff, because we're usually on the same team doing this, and we were in the case of that film, but we also felt that we'd kind of violate an unspoken rule and we'd interview the writer as well. In any case, I think Jeff is in some ways obligated and bound to explain the special connection there to that moment.
I had polio when I was 9 and spent some months in the hospital and surgery and still suffer from it some on the results of it. And it is something none of us who had it much like to talk about. I certainly didn't want to talk about it on screen. And I did it because we talked about some other things about Roosevelt. But Ken is a master interviewer, and I went into the interview determined the one thing I was not going to do was be emotional about describing how it felt to be paralyzed. Ken got me on the third question, and I couldn't help myself. My tears filled my eyes as I remembered all that stuff, and I'm glad I did it. A lot of people have said it was helpful to them, so I feel good about it now. I was sort of embarrassed then.
And one of the things you talked about was how your mother and your family, you were gripped with fear of this invisible disease. And that's what's happening today with coronavirus.
It is for somebody of my vintage, I'm 79. It is very familiar. Every summer in this country, summer camps closed, theaters closed, beaches closed. People were told to wipe surfaces. We didn't wear masks, but it is eerily reminiscent of that. We got through that one, and there eventually was a vaccine. And of course, that vaccine was the result of Franklin Roosevelt being interested in trying to find a vaccine and starting the March of Dimes when he was president of the United States. He didn't make a fuss about his own handicap, but he really inspired a country to be interested in that subject.
Well, let's move to another crisis, which was the Vietnam War. You did a beautiful documentary series on that, which is gripping. So what was interesting when I rewatched that to prepare for this was the similarities between the division in our country then and the division today. So many people say this is one of the most divisive times ever in our country. But looking at your film series on Vietnam, it almost doesn't compare to that period. So how do you compare the two periods in terms of the divisiveness in the country?
Well, I think you're right. Neither of them, that is to say this moment right now and the Vietnam period, don't compare to the Civil War. We didn't murder 750,000 of ourselves in order to not even settle the fundamental reason why it happened, but to certainly settle the question of whether states can secede or not. There are ways in which this present moment is more troubling than Vietnam, and then, of course, there are ways in which it's not. There are not, you know, mass demonstrations going on year after year after year. They're not bombings, but we do share the same divisions. They're born of the same American tendencies. I think it's really important that when Lincoln made the warning as a young lawyer that we would, you know, that we would not be attacked by someone else, he understood that the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean and two relatively benign neighbors, North and South, insulated the United States in ways that no other country or large or important country have ever been insulated. And we know the way in which the good things that get incubated in that protection, you know, that, you know, no matter how much the Germans were trying, they weren't going to cross over and make a Normandy-like landing in Montauk. It was going to come from within. Unfortunately, the things that it incubates that are positive, like freedom and this kind of curiousness and restlessness and entrepreneurial spirit, have kind of concurrent darker things. And I think as we look across the expanse of American history, people have come in, great leaders have come in, and either been able to tame that or they have exacerbated that. And it is, in fact, one great, if not the greatest, measure of leadership is, are you part of the solution or are you part of the problem? It is very fashionable to say that history repeats itself. It never, ever has, ever. Mark Twain is supposed to have said, and if he said it, it's a great comment, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think Jeff and I have been at this long enough that we know that every time we finish a film, and I assure you, we spend all of our time focused with laser attention on the story, the history that we're telling. And we get up, we realize that it is rhyming tremendously, whether it's Prohibition, whether it's Vietnam, whether it's the Roosevelts, whether it's the Civil War. Every film we've made rhymes in the present. Lincoln said in his message to Congress, what we'd call State of the Union, the dogmas of our quiet past are inadequate to our stormy present. As our case is new, we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we can save our country. So that we realize that each great crisis requires someone curious in the highest office of the land, someone curious about history, but also one realizing that if you are going to apply strictly all the lessons of the past, you will exacerbate the problem. It's a funny conundrum, and the greatest leaders have been able to do that. The greatest leaders we have all been great readers and students of history. And that's a pretty interesting fact that we can all, as we think about transitions, come to understand.
Well, based on everything you've said and how history rhymes but doesn't repeat itself, should we be optimistic or should we be just downright depressed today?
So George Will said about Franklin Roosevelt as he is assuming the mantle, he said he's armed with a Christian faith that the universe is well ordered and an American faith that history is a rising road. Despite all the facts that show how jaundiced, how selfish, how greedy, how divisive we can be, we also have these examples of how generous, how empathetic, how self-sacrificing we can be. Could there be a profession anything nobler than being a nurse today? It's not a captain of industry. It's a nurse. The captains of industry are hiding in their mansions. It's a nurse who gets on the subway or the bus and goes into trouble. I mean, we have got the opportunity here to press a kind of reset button about our values. And so as a student of history and a storyteller, I feel always optimistic, but I am not Pollyannish. I know that there are great threats and great difficulties at any moment. And we are filled with opportunity as much as we are filled with threat. And it is my fervent hope that we Americans choose the path towards finding a way to have a reset, in a very new and spectacular way, just as the other crises, the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II, they have to be seen together. And now I hope this provides us with the opportunity of recreating something new.
Very eloquent. Let me close with a couple questions about your work. So we have a number of friends in common, David Rubenstein, Alan Doctor, Bobby Stein. What do they do to support your work? And what can others who are listening do to support your amazing work to ensure that Ken Burns and Jeffrey Ward do more films?
So thank you, David, for the opportunity. Those people you mentioned are all great supporters. And David Rubenstein, the patriotic philanthropist, has generously underwritten a very large program of ours called Unum, which is attached to the PBS website and is itself alone, Ken Burns Unum, U-N-U-M, .com or pbs.org/KenBurns/Unum. And of course, it's referring to the Latin motto of the United States, E pluribus unum, out of many one. The late historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. said that we used to suffer from too much pluribus and not enough unum, and we still do. And what we're trying to do is curate the evergreen themes, the rhymes of American history, leadership, wars, politics, race, women, innovation, art, business, all sorts of themes, and collect them almost like, if you will, curate them from the films that we've made and then present them and relate them to the present moment in a way that not only teachers and students can use, but everybody in the public has. So it's attached to our educational efforts with PBS, but it's also a standalone thing, and it's just wonderful. And the rhymes are rhyming, thanks to David Rubenstein.
And what is your website if people want to go see it?
It's thebetterangels.org or it's pbs.org. And I'm in the book. So, you know, look us up. We're very happy to entertain. We've got a wonderful slate of films that we're working on. And so far, knock on wood, we've been able to, obviously some shooting has to be postponed, but we've been able to do a lot of archival research digitally. We're editing remotely together. All the editors went from the editing house to their various homes, and we edit by Zoom in all day, all week, sometimes multi-week sessions. And we're getting it done. And I would just invite all Americans who care about their country to understand that if you don't know where you've been, you can't possibly know where you are or where you're going. That's what the study of history provides you. And I'll just leave you with something David McCullough told us once about Harry Truman. He said, the only thing that's new is the history you don't know, which I just love. It means that if you are a reader and you are a student of history central to great leadership in the United States or anywhere, you've got a fighting chance to get through these things together. If you're not, the odds are against you.
Well, Ken Burns, Jeffrey Ward, you are a gift to the country. It was a gift to me to be able to share this time with you. And I'm grateful for you spending time on Transition Lab. Thank you very much.
Very much for having us. It was fun.
Thank you, David. This has been a wonderful time together. Thank you.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast apps.